Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Eventful weekend, to say the least. The Toronto Blue Jays, of course, played three games. Shohei Ohtani hit a home run off of them. Matt Chapman and manager John Schneider had a touching little moment in the dugout about that. Everything cooled off because the Blue Jays won 4-1 on Friday. Matt Chapman got his frustrations out with a solo home run, by the way. Whit Merrifield, Danny Jansen also getting home runs in that game. Saturday rolls around. They're heavy on the Shohei Ohtani intentional walks. Correction from the day before, perhaps. Alek Manoah starts, gets in a good amount of trouble, a bit of a scary and sad moment as Taylor Ward gets hit in the face with a pitch. He's been put on the 60-day IL, multiple facial fractures. It sounds like his season is likely done based on the reports from Sam Blum of The Athletic, who covers the Angels. Scary moment. And then on the baseball side of that, Alek Manoah is not asked to continue to pitch. The bullpen gets him out of it. The Jays end up winning 6-1 on a tremendous day for that bullpen. And a really good day for guys who'd been struggling a little bit. Santiago Espinal homers, Alejandro Kirk homers twice in that one. A little bit of a negative as we wrap that one out, as Jordan Romano is left Friday hurt. Saturday he's put officially on the IL. Sunday rolls around and a whole bunch more happens. Jose Berríos is solid, gets out of some trouble. The Jays bats do what they have done at times and go 2-for-16 with runners in scoring position. 10th inning comes around. No Jordan Romano. He's on the IL now. Jimmy Garcia gives up a go-ahead home run to Hunter Renfro. Despite the best efforts of Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the bottom of the 10th, he helps add one. Matt Chapman then walks, but the Jays with nobody out and two on, Strandom, Springer, Biggio, Jansen. I really, really thought Danny Jansen was going to come through in that spot, given how clutch he's been this season, but that didn't happen. Now, if you were disappointed about that, if you were negative about failing to sweep and losing the third of that series and giving the Angels a game back on the wild card, boom, Jays adjust quickly, add Jordan Hicks moments after the game, probably not related to the Jimmy Garcia blown save, maybe not even related to Jordan Romano going on the IL. These things this time of year, I've been saying over and over again that the Jays should be looking for relief help, even if you're confident in their bullpen. And then lo and behold, Jordan Romano gets hurt. Jimmy Garcia continues to look a little up and down, more good than bad over the last little while. But every bullpen, the very best bullpens, need more arms. The Toronto Blue Jays go out and acquire maybe not the very best arm, but the highest velocity arm that is going to move at the deadline, arguably the highest velocity arm in the major leagues, depending on, you know, how you chop up him and Yoan Duran. Jordan Hicks, he's an expiring contract. This is a pure rental. He's only owed about $600K the rest of the way, so not a big financial outlay, but there is a big prospect outlay. The Blue Jays give up Sem Roberta and Adam Klopfenstein, two pitchers who we've talked a lot about on this show, because Sem Roberta, as a 21-year-old at AA pushing AAA, was a guy who looked like he could pencil in as sixth man depth next season. Adam Klopfenstein, a guy who had at one point been a top prospect last year. By the end, we were pretty much all out on him, was having one of the better seasons in the Blue Jays minor league system. We'll go into some of that cost throughout the show. We've got Doug Fox, our future Blue Jays guy, who will jump on with us a little bit later to talk about the prospect side. Ricky Tiedemann and Brandon Barriera also made starts on the same day earlier this weekend in a Dunedin doubleheader. We'll talk to him about that. We've got Ben Clemens of Fangraphs coming on. Caleb Joseph, who is back in the broadcast mix for this series, will join us around 11. Katie Wu, Cardinals reporter for The Athletic, will tell us a little bit more about Jordan Hicks and the general Cardinals teardown. We're going to talk to Shai Davidi momentarily here as well. But the headline item, even taking 2 of 3 off the Angels over the weekend, the headline item is Jordan Hicks is a Toronto Blue Jay. You look at his surface stats. Yeah, he's got a 367 ERA and a pretty high walk rate. Relief pitchers are going to be noisy in certain samples. He had a very bad April. Like, borderline, is the velocity enough to keep this guy on the roster bad April? Since the end of April, 267 ERA. Component metrics that are even better than that. His walk rate is, and this is a low-ish bar, but it's 12.7% on the season. It's down under 9% since the start of June. So he started to get some of the control stuff under wraps. Now, there are also some indicators that the St. Louis system he was in was not particularly conducive to his success. For example, he is a heavy, heavy sinker baller who works down in the zone a lot. Guess which team in baseball has the worst catchers at framing low strikes? That would be the St. Louis Cardinals. Guess which team in baseball has two guys who are pretty solid at it, including Juan and Alejandro Kirk, who is really, really, really good framing low strikes. That would be the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, that's not enough to be like, okay, well, Jordan Hicks will never walk a guy again, but it helps. It moves in the right direction. And look, the big headline item, yes, there's a huge ground ball rate there. That sinker ball is a bowling ball. No righties have been able to hit it for extra bases unless they just jump out way, way, way in front of it. If it's on the outer third of the plate, you can't do anything with it other than poke it the other way. That's all great. It's also like 102 miles an hour, and he's going to miss some bats with it as well. He also throws the hardest sweeper in all of baseball, and he gets swing and miss on that almost 59% of the time. So well more than half the time, if someone offers at that sweeper, they're coming up empty. 125 batting average against, and he almost never throws that in the zone. It's very similar. It's not a similar pitch, but statistically, it's pretty similar to Trevor Richards' changeup, where it's like, man, it's never in the zone. You always swing and miss at it. Why are you swinging at it? In Jordan Hicks's case, it's because you have to defend against a fastball and sinker that have, at one point, touched 105.1 on the radar. You might see that lit up at Rogers Center on Monday or Tuesday, right next to a number that our next guest is complicit in sharing the lie of. It's a loony dog day on deadline day. These numbers continue to get inflated. Shai Davidi of Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca joins us now. Shai, are you more excited for the deadline tomorrow or the hot dog thing to take it even a step further?
Wait a minute. Are you launching a hot dog number conspiracy?
I have launched it. I have launched it in jest, and then some other outlets tried to run with it in seriousness. And so now I'm all in. And now I'm pushing this big time. And Shai, I got to say, I think you're complicit.
Well, you know what? I mean, I'm just relaying the information as it's presented to me. And, you know, this started as I was just a curiosity, like how many hot dogs does a loony dog night sell, which is just started last year. And then it's taken on it's gotten far more momentum than I expected it to. And now it's become a bit of a chore. But, you know, I think it's possible, but I'm also just sheerly fascinated by the mechanics of what it takes to store, you know, back order, fill and serve that many hot dogs in a night. It's apart from it being utterly disgusting, it's kind of incredible when you think about all the pieces that have to go into making that happen.
Now, the newest Blue Jay is a type 1 diabetic, so he can eat hot dogs, but he's going to want to be a little careful around, you know, the bread consumption, the which condiments here and there. So let's pivot to Jordan Hicks. We'll get his hot dog order a different time, I guess. But the Jays make a pretty big splash yesterday. Jordan Hicks, one of the biggest names that'll move at this deadline on the reliever market. Certainly the hardest throwing, a pure rental, so a bit of a price here with Semro Bersa and Adam Klofenstein going the other way. What was your initial reaction to, you know, I don't even know if you guys were done. I don't think you were. You weren't even done post-game stuff yesterday. And the news comes down that, hey, the Jays are adding Jordan Hicks to this bullpen.
Yeah, I mean, we started hearing it in the clubhouse. I think I just had gotten done chatting with Yenesis Cabrera when I got the first indications of it. And it's a fascinating deal. Look, this is also, to me, I guess my first reaction was this is different from other deals that this front office has made. This is the first time they've gone for an elite rental type of player. You know, the closest comp you can make is Jose Barrios, but there's still another year of control there. So this is a short runway to potentially extend him if you want to extend him. But you think about the injury to Jordan Romano, you know, right away, you know, Saturday I wrote about how his loss is going to force them to maybe rethink their deadline strategy, maybe become a bit more aggressive there. And, you know, if the Blue Jays were maybe kicking around, you know, do we do this? Do we not? Once you lose Jordan Romano, all of a sudden, I think it becomes almost imperative that you get that impact if you knew it was available to you. And so this is a potentially a very pricey deal. You know, both Roberta and Klopfenstein could have been the type of up and down starting depth, if not more than that, within the next year. And they could have definitely factored into the 2024 season for them. And, you know, they both have some upside. But the Blue Jays are in a window where they have to leverage the group that they have. And so, you know, Jordan Hicks does that. You've got a bit of runway to maybe build a relationship. The Blue Jays would have an indication of what it might take to extend him, given the fact that he's engaged in some talks with the Cardinals. So if they can build a good relationship, they'll get a jump there. And maybe this doesn't have to be a short-term play, but this is a ton of impact in an area that you need it. And you think about how teams win in the playoffs. They win with elite bullpens, and then, you know, you pair Romano and Hicks together. I mean, that's Cano-Batista kind of stuff, where, you know, just absolutely elite back end of the bullpen.
Yeah, the Jays now the only team in baseball with four relievers who have a swinging strike or a whiff rate higher than 30%. You can add Swanson and Richards into that, and maybe your confidence varies in those guys in super high leverage, but having four guys who can miss bats. I remember Shai talking at the deadline last year when the Jays added Anthony Bass and Zach Pop, and it was like, well, those are nice guys, but that bullpen didn't have a lot of swing and miss at that time. Trevor Richards has improved so much, and the acquisition of Eric Swanson in the offseason, they really do have a bat missing back end now. You mentioned the Jordan Romano injury. Jordan Hicks has a little bit of experience closing games. He has eight saves this year. He saved some games in 2018, 2019. He also was a starter to start last year and has been used for six out saves a handful of times this year. Do you have a sense, or is it too early, of exactly what the deployment of Hicks could be like? Because before the Romano injury, I kind of saw him as like someone else you could plug into the Pearson role of, yes, they're available in leverage, but also if you need someone for, you know, top of the order through the fifth and sixth, the guy who could come in and give you some length. Do you have a sense yet of what Hicks's ultimate role could be with this club?
I don't yet. And I think to some extent we may see it vary because the needs are going to change over the coming weeks, right? If Jordan Romano is indeed just going to be the 15 days, and those are at least the indications, the early indications on that. But I can also see them potentially extending it to just really knock out these back issues as best as possible so it doesn't keep creeping into things down the road. You would think that of all the guys who could get outs in the ninth, he might be the guy most suited to that, at least for the time being. And then when Romano comes back, then you can play him or use him in a series of different roles. And maybe it's middle of seventh through the eighth kind of bridge to Jordan, or maybe it's a key spot earlier in the game where, you know, the middle of the lineup is up against in a situation of leverage that you can go to him there. I just think that he gives you more opportunities to mix and match in different ways and just have a weapon almost unlike any other in the big leagues. And so, you know, down the road, could you look at him maybe as a starter again? Could you look at him in a number of different roles? Sure. But my sense is for the time being, he comes in, goes in the back end of the bullpen, and you figure it out from there.
With Hicks, obviously there is the bat missing stuff with that awesome sweeper. There's the high velocity. But the biggest thing for him is this sky-high ground ball rate. 58.3% of balls in play are on the ground. That's one of the highest marks in baseball. You know, we saw against Seattle, Taylor Saucedo, and what that did in a big spot. Or we saw Yoan Duran a couple times this year for the Twins, and how, you know, in his case, a very similar heavy sinker with good velocity like that can play. And I know this is something we'll probably learn more from the Jays in how they use Hicks and once all the deadline moves are in. But this is a team that talks a lot about, you know, pockets of the order and different matchups and things like that. Hicks's ability to not only be a ground ball type, but also someone who pushes that velocity lever a little bit. And we know there are guys like an Aaron Judge on the Yankees who is so dangerous, but the 100 plus velocity is maybe a bit of a weak spot. Kyle Tucker on the Astros. The versatility that this bullpen has here now, do you see there being an element they're still missing in that bullpen, or are you pretty comfortable with where the bullpen is at, assuming health for Romano?
Yeah. Look, I just think it's starting to get hard to get better at this point, right? You've got, it's a small sample and you want to be wary of trusting it, but there is some track record there for Yenesis Cabrera. And now you've got two guys who throw swing and miss stuff from the left side. So you've got some backup for Tim Meza. And you probably feel a little bit better about how you're situated from the left side. And then you think about Pearson and you know, being able to maybe ease the workload a bit on Eric Swanson and Jimmy Garcia and Tim Meza, so you're consistently getting the best version of those three guys. And, you know, they've carried an exceptionally heavy workload to this point, so they're certainly deserving of that. You think about Chad Green potentially coming in and joining the mix too. There's just going to be a lot of weapons. There's some layers of protection. And, you know, again, you're still waiting to see it at the big league level, but I was talking to someone yesterday and they thought that from what they're seeing from Chad Green so far, that they think that he can definitely be a factor. Now, can he recover enough in a meaningful enough way where, you know, you could pitch him back-to-back days or you could pitch him 3 times in 4 days if you had to do that? That's the test that they're still, that's the hurdle, I guess, he still has to clear. But those are a lot of pieces. Those are a lot of weapons with some experience and leverage, with some ability to get swing and miss or to get a ground ball or to do all the different things that you need. You know, I just think the way that's set up, you're probably feeling pretty good about that. And then, you know, you think that at this point the Blue Jays start devoting the rest of the prospect capital they feel they can sacrifice over to the offensive piece.
So the other element of this addition is, and yeah, we could talk about the rental aspect or the cost, but I thought the way you structured your story last night at sportsnet.ca was terrific in that, like, right out of the gate, you're kind of like, here are three quotes from guys who are just so fired up to hear this news. Whit Merrifield, Matt Chapman, Kevin Gausman, you know, two of those guys who we usually hear a lot from and are generally fired up. But to get Kevin Gausman excited and have him, like, off of his even keel a little bit is pretty rare. When you see that and you hear those guys reacting in that way, you know, obviously it's great that they feel good about it. Do you think that there's an impact to that as the Jays look at, hey, the next 36 hours? And, you know, obviously we're looking around and lots of teams are adding, but the fact that this was immediately pretty galvanizing in the room and the guys were fired up about having additions, do you think that carries weight at all?
Perhaps. Right. I thought it was interesting. The one of the comments that Gausman made was that, you know, he'd been on teams where they hadn't made moves and the group kind of looks around and is like, well, you know, why didn't we get this guy or why couldn't we get that guy? And it can be a bit deflating. And, you know, I think about the year the Jays got David Cohn and hearing some of the stories the Blue Jays said from Blue Jays players that year, kind of remembering how what a lift it was to see David Cohn go to the Jays, and then conversely Paul Molitor, who was on the Brewers at the time and they were chasing the Jays, remembers kind of like thinking like, what, how did they get him? And it was deflating for them. And so there's still time obviously for the other teams in the American League East to make moves, but it hasn't been particularly active from the AL East, especially considering how tightly bunched up those teams are. So, you know, if there aren't sort of commensurate moves on the other clubs, then there can be a potentially deflating effect there too. So, you know, I think it's short-lived. Jordan Hicks has to arrive and pitch well for the good vibes to continue, right? It's great that they got him, but, you know, if he isn't able to hit the ground running, then all that disappears in a hurry. So, you know, there's certainly a benefit. I'm not sure how long-term it is, but, you know, we've also seen, you can think back to 2015 here, and when the Blue Jays made the moves there, how it ignited that team. So there can be, there certainly can be an impact. How long-term it is ultimately depends on how the group comes together afterwards.
I agree, Shai. They should go out and trade for Troy Tulowitzki now as well, or some version of that. Shai, something you mentioned off the top is that this was a bit of a novel move for this front office in that it is a pure rental. And yes, they could work out something with Hicks. They could re-sign him in free agency, but you could do that anyway. This is not a guy with control. And they traded two pieces who, I understand Roberta and Klopfenstein, you know, they would have been Rule 5 eligible this winter. Maybe they're guys that, hey, the Jays just weren't going to be comfortable with that decision just yet on them. But they're pieces and pieces who maybe could have been 2024 depth. When you see that, do you think we should view that as a change in thinking from this front office for this deadline? Would you be more or less surprised now if they went out and added another rental piece, say a Marcana type or something like that, where, you know, you and I, even talking the other day at the park, we're kind of looking mostly at guys with a little bit of control and you know, because that's been how this front office operates, them pushing chips in for a rental. Does that change what you're thinking this next day or two now at all?
Maybe, but, you know, if I'm taking a step back, to some extent, it's also a degree of what the market is presenting, mm-hmm. right? And this is maybe atypical is strong, but maybe a bit unusual for a market where, you know, a lot of teams that you would typically think would be selling are just kind of hanging in there because the standings are so bunched up. And that rather than sort of, usually when you get closer to the deadline, you get teams peel off and they're like, okay, this isn't going to be realistic for us. But, you know, in theory, you would have thought the Angels would be sellers, and here they are as buyers. And in theory, you would think, okay, the Cubs, even though they're, you know, within range of the AL Central lead and the NL wild card, there are a lot of teams in that wild card mix who, on paper at least, look to be better than them, but they seem set to be hanging in. So there just aren't as many options on this market, and you've seen the price has been pretty high. You've seen a lot of top 100 prospects go in various deals that have already been made. And you kind of take a step back and be like, okay, well, teams aren't really sacrificing the guys of control. The rentals are exacting a pretty high price. This is what it costs to do business. And, you know, if you're just kind of casting forward to 24, I mean, the Blue Jays are going to have a fair amount of work to do to be as good a team in 24 as they are right now in 23. You know, they're going to have Matt Chapman be a free agent, Brandon Belt, Kevin Kiermaier, but likely Whit Merrifield, Hyunjin Ryu. I mean, that's a lot of talent that you have to replace. And so they are going to have some money coming off the books. But the fact is that this is a good opportunity right now. You've got a lot of talent that you may not be able to replace in exactly the same way this offseason. So there's a little bit of urgency to the moment too. So I think those are a combination of factors that lead you down this path. And ultimately, I think from a bullpen perspective, if you were just adding sort of, it wouldn't make sense to just add an average kind of reliever type just right to have depth. You needed to add impact. I think on the position player side, you can certainly add a complementary piece and still impact your roster. But I also do think that we may potentially see them try to do something a bit more substantial as well.
Ooh, I like that. I like that, Shai. Okay, so the price tag here, fairly steep for a rental. Sam Roberta, Adam Klopfenstein, per Baseball America's latest update, that is the number 7 and 18 prospect respectively in the system, and two of the higher guys if you were looking ahead to 2024 starting pitching depth. I know Roberta's story is a fun one that you've told in the past. So was your sense in these two guys being the price tag, hey, it's what the market required, or had the front office, I mean, Klopfenstein was borderline out as a prospect last year. This might just be him repeating double A in, you know, fairly deep into his pro career at this point. But with Roberta, was there a cooling off on him, or is this just the cost of doing business?
I think this is just the cost of doing business, right? And I think what gives you a little bit of pause is that these are, and this is hard to find, increasingly hard to find, but these are two guys who have been developed and have been carrying innings in a traditional starter role throughout their minor league careers. And again, you see a lot of pitchers that you have to go slow with, you have to really limit the workload, and it's a very gradual ascension up the number of innings thrown ladder. Whereas these guys have done it and they keep on carrying it. They've been strong. That that's tough to find. And so the Blue Jays haven't developed a ton of those guys. You know, we've talked a lot over the past couple of years about the lack of upper minor league level starting depth. You know, Klofenstein and Sam Reversa could have, in theory, both been a AAA Buffalo next year, knocking on the door, ready to be there if someone has to go down or there's an injury to cover. So that piece is something that the Blue Jays will certainly have to worry about. Obviously, if Ricky Tiedemann, who was back pitching on the weekend, if he gets back to form and he's knocking on the door next year, then, you know, you feel a little bit better than that. But ideally, you want more than just one guy there. So that's the piece that worries you, I think, if you're the Blue Jays front office. But that's the price of doing business. And, you know, these deals, if you're going to get good players, these deals are going to hurt. And that's what kind of where the Blue Jays are at right now.
And hey, if the player ends up being good, you're pretty fine with that. The counter to that is the other element of this transaction, which is that Mitch White has been designated for assignment. Now, still a little bit of time here before the deadline for a potential waiver deal. Some, you know, non-competitive team thinks they can give Mitch White some innings, some runway. There's also, if he clears waivers, you can outright him once down to AAA. Do you have a favorite moment from the Mitch White era?
Nothing comes to mind. Blake.
I appreciated that he ended a very long West Coast game nice and quickly when he came in.
I'm not sure that's one necessarily one for the highlight reel. Look, I think this is a frustrating one for the Blue Jays, mm-hmm. because, you know, you look back at the time and you can understand why they made that deal. They needed some up and down AAA depth who could come in and pitch. And the guys had some success and had some good moments with the Dodgers. You think, all right, this is someone who's going to help. And then he comes into spring training this year and he's got the shoulder issue and he's never able to really get on track. The Blue Jays can't give him enough runway in order to try and find himself, to try to get himself right. And so, you know, I personally think there's a little bit more to Mitch White than what he's shown, and that there is some value there. But the type of situation that the Blue Jays were in, how do you help a guy get confidence without runway? But how do you give a guy runway when he doesn't have any confidence and you're trying to win? So it was a bit of an impossible situation there at the end with Mitch White. And, you know, maybe the Blue Jays can tack him on to a deal to get an extra couple percent or for somebody. Maybe that's how it plays out. But, you know, I think this is one that, again, was a deal made because the Blue Jays were trying to win last year and were trying to augment and bolster their big league staff, protect against injuries, and ended up costing them a decent prospect in Nick Frasso.
The other trade deadline deal last year worked out pretty well. And then the other one, the Bass Pop, Jordan Groshans one, it might end up being a big nothing looking at what all three of those guys are doing right now. Shai, quickly before I let you go, we did get to watch Shohei Ohtani all weekend, 4-for-9 with a double that was like maybe more impressive than the home run because it was just a ground ball that rolled all the way to the wall. Also that laser of a home run in the opener, 4 intentional walks. Did you get a moment to enjoy the Shohei experience around all the chaos that was going on?
Yeah, for sure. It's pretty clear. It's been clear for a while now that what we're watching is something that, you know, it's not even generational. Right? I mean, what's the real, you think about it, what's the real comp for him? Like Babe Ruth in that era? I was talking when I was at the Hall of Fame last week, I was talking to some people there. One of the interesting discussion points is just how in the current game, the difference between floor and ceiling between players, like the gap between the worst and the best is maybe as narrow as it's ever been in the history of the game. And then you've got like Shohei Ohtani, who's just like, okay, this is like video game mode. That level of ridiculous dominance. So we're seeing something absolutely special. The thing that he's doing against the quality of competition today is, I mean, relative to baseball history, I'm not sure that there's really a suitable comp. And so it's anytime you get an opportunity to witness it, it's pretty incredible. And I got to watch him during the Jays series in Anaheim earlier this season, and again now, and it's pretty wild stuff.
It's pretty incredible. I was happy to get to watch Saturday's game with you and BNS down at the park. Shai, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man.
Yeah, anytime, Blake. Be well, dude.
Shai Davidi, columnist and MLB insider at Sportsnet.ca. Be sure to keep up on all of Shai's stuff, Ben Nicholson-Smith, Arden Zwelling, David Singh. We will have loads at Sportsnet.ca over the next couple days, of course. Ben Nicholson-Smith has a piece up on Jordan Hicks this morning. Shai had the reaction from in the clubhouse last night. There were also games this weekend that those guys wrote about while I just kind of put my feet up in the Sportsnet media seats next to them and just bothered them for the entire Saturday game. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to get the Cardinals side of this. We're going to talk to Katie Wu, who covers the team for The Athletic. There's a lot that has gone into this trade from the Cardinals side. Not only the Jordan Hicks extension talks, which might be helpful to hear about if you're looking at what his future with the Toronto Blue Jays may look like, but also this is a rare teardown for the St. Louis Cardinals, and there are more pieces to go that... Look, they've already made two trades with the Cardinals. I think if there were other names that the Jays liked off that team, you could have just folded them into another deal. But the Tyler O'Neill's, Jack Flaherty's of the world could end up on teams the Jays are competing with. We'll take a break. We'll talk to Katie Wu of The Athletic about what's going on with the Cardinals as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Discussing the biggest stories that matter to Toronto sports fans. The Fan Morning Show with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Toronto Blue Jays take 2-3 against the Angels. They'll start a four-game series against the Baltimore Orioles down at Rogers Center. Tonight, Chris Bassitt and Kyle Gibson, the matchup in the opener there. We don't know who's pitching for Baltimore on Thursday because they sent Tyler Wells and his sub-4 ERA all the way down to AA to try to get right. At some point in this series, we will also see... Well, not at some point. On Tuesday, we'll see the return of Hyunjin Ryu after 13 or 14 months recovering from elbow reconstruction surgery. And at some point in this series, we will likely see the newest Toronto Blue Jay, Jordan Hicks. They acquired Jordan Hicks from the St. Louis Cardinals yesterday for Sem Roberta and Adam Klofenstein. Katie Wu, Cardinals writer for The Athletic, joins us now to help break it down. Katie, how are you?
I am great. How are you? Good morning. And I love the Taylor Swift intro, which just really started my week off on a great note.
I'm glad to hear that. I know you're a fan. Tried to guess right on a song choice there. So we're off to a good start. Less good start, the St. Louis Cardinals, but maybe a nice 48 hours ahead. You're going to be busy. The Cardinals are going to do a lot here. I guess before we get into the specifics, the unusualness of this situation for the St. Louis Cardinals as sellers and as aggressive sellers. What have you made of this last week or so and John Mozeliak kind of making the decision to go down this route?
Yeah, certainly uncharted territory for the St. Louis Cardinals. You know, when you think about the Cardinals, they're almost always in contention and they're almost never true sellers. This is the first time the Cardinals are selling under John Mozeliak's tenure. He's been the head of president of baseball operations for 15 years. So clearly this is, again, uncharted territory for fans here in St. Louis. But I think the front office was pretty adamant in what they were looking to do at the trade deadline. It has not been a good season for St. Louis. They've spent the majority of the year in last place in a relatively weak NL Central division. Their priority is to bolster a competitive club for 2024. They're doing that by focusing on trading away players that have expiring contracts at the end of the year. That, of course, would be Jordan Hicks, who traded to the Blue Jays yesterday afternoon. And it seems like they're targeting bolstering their pitching depth at this point of the year. They really don't have a lot of pitching in their farm system, especially at the upper levels. So I thought the return that the Cardinals got for Hicks certainly fit what they were looking for, but definitely not easy to part with Jordan, who has, you know, was drafted by the Cardinals and has spent the entire portion of his major league career in St. Louis.
In Klofenstein and Roberta, yes, the Cardinals are getting a couple guys. They've assigned both of them directly to AAA, so obviously they think they're not too far away. And those are two guys, Katie, that have eaten a lot of innings already and have some swing and miss stuff. I know you had a quote in your write-up about it, about how the Cardinals are looking particularly at that kind of swing and miss stuff as they restock the pitching parts of their minor league system. Is the hope now, and I know the talking point and the decision to not have Arenado on the trade table is about competing again in 2024. And I'd imagine the focus on controllable arms here is about getting back to, you know, I guess making sure there's not another 2023 over the next like 10 years. Is that kind of the thinking here with the aggression we're going to see?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think the last thing this organization wants is another 2023, and it's certainly the last thing the fan base wants. I mean, you think about it, the Cardinals have not had a losing season in 15 years, so this is a pretty staggering year for St. Louis, but I think the Cardinals are going about this the right way. It's difficult to acknowledge in July that your team is not going to contend for the next 2 months, but by selling up these guys that have expiring contracts, you know, they tried to work out an extension with Jordan Hicks. It didn't happen. So by giving these rentals to contending teams, they're able to get these prospects that they desperately need without totally decimating the core of their roster. Because despite what's happened in St. Louis this year, I do believe the Cardinals have a very substantial core, especially when you take into consideration Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado. Where they really need help, of course, is pitching. And you're not going to address the starting rotation and be ready for 2024 at this trade deadline. You know, the Cardinals are not going to be a finished product come August 1st. But what they are doing this trade deadline is they're laying the groundwork for what is going to be a very busy offseason so the Cardinals can compete in 2024. The last thing you want to do from John Mozeliak's perspective is waste the prime years of Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado. And they really need to capitalize on that, as Goldschmidt will be a free agent after 2024.
Yeah, those guys are pretty good. I'd be trying to maximize 2024 as well. Now, you mentioned there was the potential to maybe extend Jordan Hicks. He's a bit of an interesting case because he is about to be a free agent, but he's only 26. It's just he got to the majors so quickly before the elbow kind of fell apart and required Tommy John and a long time on the way back on the IL, pushing that service time ahead. What was your sense of what those extension talks were like, and would you anticipate the Blue Jays, you know, touching base on that, or was the sense that you got that, hey, Hicks wants to be a kind of bet on myself kind of guy, see what's there in free agency?
Yeah, you know, I think players have that right. You know, if you spend 6 years in the major leagues, that's an incredible accomplishment in itself, and you have the right to test the waters and bet on yourself in free agency. I know Jordan would have liked to stay in St. Louis, but he's certainly excited to be in Toronto and pitching for a competitive team. Like I said, that pitching for a competitive team is really all he knows, because usually the Cardinals are one of those teams. But I would imagine Jordan tests the free agency waters once he gets there. I know it's pretty complicated in terms of the extension, because the Cardinals were a timeline, right? If they were going to extend Jordan Hicks, that needed to have been done pretty soon, because they are sellers and they do carry the most leverage at the trade deadline, especially in the pitching market. They couldn't go to the 11th hour with Jordan and then have an extension not fall through and then suddenly not been able to trade him for the maximum return. I thought, again, what the Cardinals got in the Blue Jays is a pretty good return for a rental piece. And I think the Blue Jays will really find a liking to Jordan Hicks, especially with Jordan Romano on the IL. I mean, Hicks is nasty, guys. He can throw 103, sick movement, and he's just a fun guy. Certainly someone that will be missed in the Cardinals clubhouse. But he'll get a chance to reunite with Henesis Cabrera, whose Toronto career is off to a pretty good start from the box score, at least from what I can see. So good stuff to see Jordan in Toronto, and I'm sure he'll enjoy being part of a high leverage role in the bullpen for a competitive team. He certainly did a great job with that last year.
He did, and he's had kind of a fascinating year, really a fascinating couple years here with such a great start, and then the injury issues, transition back to being a starter for a bit last year, and then the awful April this year before really being one of the best relievers in baseball since the start of May. I know you had mentioned in your write-up of this trade, Katie, that there was a bit of a tweak, first of all, on where he stands on the mound, but also to his pregame routine and approach. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what Hicks has kind of done to click things into place since the start of May?
Yeah, of course. And so when Jordan Hicks started out in April, he wasn't really being used in high leverage situations. He was sixth and seventh innings, but they was, you know, close games, one or two run leads, I should say. And it was very surprising to see him miss his spot so poorly, hang his slider, which can be a real weapon for him when it's right, and just kind of go out there with no confidence. He was wild. He was erratic. He was walking guys. He just couldn't get people out. And it came to the point where the Cardinals had a decision to make. They couldn't option him to AAA because he had just reached 5 years of service time, but they didn't want to DFA him exactly for this reason. If they got him right, he would either be a valuable asset for them or for another team, and then they could again get exactly what they did yesterday. So they stuck with it, and they moved him down to even lower leverage roles. That was pretty difficult to do because at that point the Cardinals were still somewhat in contention. But he worked extensively with pitching coach Dusty Blake, who moved him to the other side of the rubber. And more importantly, in Jordan's mind, he fixed his pregame routine in terms of coming out with more intent, more focus. You know, he said, sometimes I could get a little just like going to warm up and not really going through the motions, but I started warming up with intent. I'm really realizing what I needed to do to be focused to come into that start, and having that focus and intent when I got to the mound instead of trying to get it as I was pitching. And sometimes guys like that just need a reminder. Relievers are a rare breed, as you know. But I think Jordan was pretty honest in his self-reflection, took 4 or 5 days to really kind of revamp his personal mindset, and he's been lights out ever since.
I'm sure Jordan wouldn't point the blame elsewhere, and I don't mean to do that as well, but another factor here that has crossed my mind, especially for a pitcher who works so heavily in the bottom part of the zone with that heavy sinker, there have not been the greatest of reports about the catching performance of the St. Louis Cardinals this year, specifically with Wilson Contreras. And I know that that's something you had to, you know, write about a ton in the early part of the season. Most of the metrics don't love Andrew Knizner's defense back there either. Could you see that being a component of it, at least as far as the early season walk rates are concerned?
Maybe just in terms of trust, right? Jordan Hicks was very young when he debuted with the Cardinals, and the only catcher he's ever had to throw with was Yadier Molina, and when Yadier Molina throws a sign down, you do it, right? And when Andrew Knizner was behind the plate in those rare opportunities, well, Jordan went through the system with Kiz, so they had that trust factor. I'm not quite sure that was established in spring training, because it's very, very hard to do, and that's no fault of either player. And then the first outing that Jordan had with Wilson, a wild pitch skirted away and actually hit him in the knee and knocked him out for 2 days. That was on opening day. So maybe a premonition of how the season was going to go for St. Louis. So I think it took a little while for those guys to build up their trust, but I could see both of them after games in early April sitting together, hyping each other up, talking over pitch movement. And after Jordan's first good outing in May, Wilson was the first guy at his locker hyping him up and giving him props. So I could definitely see it, but I wouldn't attribute it to the issue.
That opener back against the Blue Jays, when we all thought these were going to be two really good teams, and that series of them going blow for blow was, a sign of things to come for both sides. So you mentioned that Jordan Hicks should also probably fit in pretty well to the clubhouse. What is it about him you think would make him an easy guy to transition team to team here and kind of find his footing quickly from the personal or soft side of things?
Funny guy. I told him yesterday I genuinely looked forward to talking to him every day, because he just never knew what was going to come out of his mouth. And he's just kind of like a funny, little bit introverted kind of guy. But, you know, he really likes to put on for his city, and he really likes to put on for his team. And I think he'll be a little bit more comfortable again with Cabrera there. They were teammates for almost 4 years in the reliever or in the bullpen. And, you know, bullpen guys, they bond really quickly, because what else are you going to do for 9 innings back there? But I think Blue Jays fans will really like Jordan, because he just brings a bit of swagger to his performance. He is really fun to watch when he is right. I mean, who doesn't like seeing 103 consistently flashed on that scoreboard? And I know the Blue Jays are having a season that, well, maybe not as dismal as the Cardinals. It's not one that's gone according to plan. So I think Jordan can bring a little bit of a boost to a team that is looking to make a push in the second half, and I think he'll be able to help.
I have to ask one Jordan Hicks related goodbye question, and I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but Emo's Pizza, he posted it last night, his goodbye meal. Is it legitimately really good, or is it just kind of a St. Louis staple that he had to show out for the city on his way out?
Oh, Blake, I think you're going to get me canceled in St. Louis, but
oh, no.
I'm going to be honest. I'm going to say it. I'm not an Emo's girl,
okay.
But my friends who have lived here their whole life, they love it. So who am I to say it's not good? I'm just saying it's not for me. I think it's like a St. Louis staple way of life. And I've embraced plenty of things about St. Louis, but Emo's, unfortunately, I don't think is going to be making the cut for me.
That's okay. We'll have to guide Jordan to the correct places here in Toronto. So you had mentioned Genesis Cabrera, also a guy that the Jays just picked up. Are you... are you surprised at all to see him hit the ground running in the way that he has with Toronto, or is this something that the Cardinals knew was in there, they just kind of ran out of time to try to get it out of him?
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. I think his time with the Cardinals had reached a pretty clear end. He wasn't happy with his leverage usage. This is, again, a guy that was used to competing in high leverage situations and being on a winning team. And the Cardinals were in a position where they have to pivot to 2024 and give a lot of those younger guys in AAA a time to go out and perform so that they know that they can be counted on next year. And Cabrera's usage had fallen because his ERA had risen at the same time. He wasn't performing like the Cardinals knew he could. He wasn't happy with his usage. His usage wasn't going to improve, again, because there were other guys in AAA the Cardinals needed to know what they had in, so I thought it was a good time. Cabrera was likely to be traded anyway, just given the way that the roster was shaking out, so I guess they were just ahead of the game, but not at all surprising to see Cabby do what he does. He really is a great teammate to have when things are going well for a team, and he really welcomes that high leverage role. So I don't know. I think Toronto could have, especially when Romano gets back, a pretty intense bullpen going forward.
It looks that way. Some real swing and miss stuff back there, and Cabrera obviously adding an element to the left side. Katie, it's going to be a busy day or two for you, so I will let you go here shortly. But Hicks, Montgomery, Stratton, all out. Are we looking at Tyler O'Neill next, Jack Flaherty, Paul DeJong? What is next? It certainly seemed from the quotes in your story that the Cardinals are not done with this fire sale.
They are not, and John Mozeliak said as much. He said probably moves will still be made, and I think that's Mo speak for there will be moves made. He doesn't like to speak in absolutes, but when he's that definitive about something, you can pretty much read it for what it is. If he sticks to his typical and traditional mold of what he's done so far, the next guys to be gone will be the guys that remain on expiring contracts. That would be Jack Flaherty and Paul DeJong. Both will be free agents for the first time at the end of 2023. DeJong does have a $12.5 million team option, but with Mason Winn, their top prospect, a shortstop, knocking out the door at AAA, hitting 400 this month.
Oh.
I don't see a reality where DeJong is that option is picked up. And there could be other guys on the move as well. Tyler O'Neill has all been safe, actually, mainly because he just got back from injury, and the selling point for him is very low at this point. So mm-hmm. The Cardinals would be more likely to trade someone like Dylan Carlson, who has a couple of years of team control, can play all three positions in the outfield, and is a switch hitter. But when you think about that, that's a lot to give up if you get him right. I think that plenty of people are on the block for Mo. But if I was going to take any bets, if I was a betting woman, I would bet on the next two trades being Paul DeJong and Jack Flaherty, potentially even as a package.
That would make a lot of sense for a lot of teams. And Flaherty, you know, we'll see with the Cubs not putting guys on the market anymore. He might be the top starting pitching name left. So the Cardinals can continue to kind of restock that farm system on the fly here. Katie Wu of The Athletic, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning.
You got it. Talk to you soon.
Katie Wu of The Athletic, make sure to check out her work for the Cardinal side of not only this trade, but Jordan Montgomery and Chris Stratton getting dealt as well. They're off to the Texas Rangers, along with Max Scherzer from the Mets. A lot to sort through there. So between these two trades, the Cardinals have picked up, John King, a reliever from the Rangers, but also the Rangers number 13 and number 15 prospects, the Blue Jays number 7 and number 18 prospects. And yes, prospect rankings are whatever. Those are the latest updates from Baseball America in their midseason, each team's top 30. So not a bad haul for top 20 prospects or so for a couple of expiring pieces and more work to be done for the Cardinals. Before we take a break and talk to Caleb Joseph on the other side, a couple small updates from the weekend. First, Jimmy Garcia reached his vesting threshold over the weekend, so he has now pitched in enough games over 2022 and 2023 that what was before a team option for next year is now $6 million guaranteed. So Jimmy Garcia in the mix for next year at $6 million. Hyunjin Ryu is going to start Tuesday. We'll talk about that a ton tomorrow, I'm sure. Chad Green made his third rehab appearance on Saturday with single-A Dunedin. He threw 1 1/3 innings, struck out 3, was in the 93-95 range with the fastball. The only base runner he allowed was a reach on error. So he's now made 3 appearances, 3 1/3 innings. He has gone 1 batter over the minimum. He has allowed a couple hits, but then immediately got double plays in his earlier starts. So Chad Green, we anticipate his next rehab assignment coming at AAA Buffalo as he continues to ramp up. Ricky Tiedemann made his latest start on the weekend as well, as did Brandon Barriera. They started both heads of a doubleheader with Dunedin, which is pretty fun if you're a Jays prospect fan. But we'll save that talk for when Doug Fox joins us around 11:25. We'll talk to Ben Clemens of Fangraphs in the second hour as well. And after the break here, we'll tag in Caleb Joseph, see what his impressions of Jordan Hicks are, and what it's like to be in a clubhouse these days, as he was a part of some Orioles teams that were very aggressive, the 2014 team adding Andrew Miller at the deadline, and teams that were less aggressive, a 2016 Orioles team that probably should have added a little bit more, but worked out okay for the Toronto Blue Jays side of things. Caleb Joseph joins Jays Talk Plus next on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That is a song called Flamethrower, which is not Jordan Hicks's walkout music. He comes out to the Mbappe remix, but that is not radio appropriate, Jordan Hicks. So we'll go with Flamethrower by King Gizzard and Lizard Wizard. Instead, I feel like spiritually, that is a pretty good song for a guy who sits 102, 103 with good movement on his sinker. Before we get Caleb Joseph here, while we connect with him, a couple of stats about Jordan Hicks. 105.1 miles per hour is the fastest he's thrown a pitch as measured by StatCast tools. That is tied with Aroldis Chapman for the fastest pitch recorded in the StatCast era. Also in the StatCast era, this one comes via Codify Baseball. That's 2008 to now. No Toronto Blue Jay has thrown 102 miles an hour. Nate Pearson's come close, but hasn't quite cracked that threshold. Jordan Hicks has done it 370 times. That's a lot of velocity. Both his fastball, his four-seamer, and his sinker are two of the top six pitches in the league in terms of average velocity. And he, of course, even more so than Yoan Duran, leads the league in 100-mile-an-hour pitches this year. Now, velocity is not everything. You have to be able to control it. He dealt with some control issues early in the year. He has a 12.7 walk rate on the season, but he's been able to trim that since the start of June down to roughly a league average, even a slightly below league average level. You'd still like that to be better, sure. But as Chris Black has pointed out on Twitter, at Down to Black, he has a terrific thread on Jordan Hicks today that goes into some of his ground ball profile, some of, you know, where Hicks could maybe even be a little better, especially with two strikes, you know, staying away from hitters, not trying to jam in for the swing and miss. But a right-handed hitter can do nothing against that sinker if he locates it on the outer third. Also some evidence to suggest that he could benefit from the Toronto Blue Jays catchers, especially Alejandro Kirk, who is one of the very best in the league at framing strikes right along the border at the bottom of the zone. That is an area that the Cardinals catchers, Contreras and Kisner, have been dead last in baseball at. The question, though, becomes with Jordan Hicks is, when a guy's throwing 102, 103, sometimes 105, is that a little tougher to frame? Is it a little tougher to catch in general? Caleb Joseph, analyst for Blue Jay Central and Sportsnet, joins us now. Caleb, how are you this morning, buddy?
Great. What a beautiful morning, Toronto, in the city. Wow.
It is a great one, and it's a morning where Jays fans could shake off yesterday's loss and be excited about a new addition in Jordan Hicks. Got to ask you, Caleb, I don't know if you ever caught 105, but a guy who's popping the radar gun in the hundreds, is that tougher to catch behind the plate? I'm thinking specifically when it comes to, like, you know, trying to frame and steal a strike right on the edge. Do you kind of just have to sit back and focus on receiving?
You know what? To be honest with you, Blake, a lot of it just depends on what it feels like back there. If that makes any sense. Like,
we're going to have to reconnect, Caleb. Caleb, we're going to have to reconnect with you, buddy.
Okay.
Caleb Joseph, we'll try to reconnect with him and rejoin him in a second here. We were losing him in and out. Curious as to what his answer is to whether it's tougher to catch and tougher to frame those elite velocities. A little bit more on that trade. In terms of an extension, our pal Keith Law at The Athletic was not in favor of an extension off of this, in addition to the control issues, citing the fact that Hicks has already had Tommy John at one point. Although that always makes me wonder, is that fine? He's already had the Tommy John. What are you going to do? Tear my UCL again? It's happened, but you'd think, at least for a little bit, he's okay there. So Jordan Hicks, big velocity on the fastball and the sinker, big ground ball rates, but it's also worth keeping an eye on that sweeper or slider if you prefer. It shape-wise is more of a sweeper, but I know some people have not adopted that terminology. Whatever you want to call it, 59% whiff rate, so 59% of the time, if a batter swings at it, they're going to miss. 125 batting average against, gets a ton of bad swings at pitches outside of the zone on it. Now, this has cost the Jays a little bit. Semer Barisa, Adam Klofenstein, Mitch White is DFA'd, and he finishes with, if we lower the cutoffs enough, the fourth worst ERA in Jays history at 760. Now, he might not be done. It's possible the Jays don't trade him. If he clears waivers, he could be outrighted to AAA and then find his way back at some time, similar to Jordan Luplo, similar to Bowden Francis. It's not necessarily the end, but it is the end for right now. Caleb Joseph is back. Caleb, catching elite velocity, harder, easier? You just got to simplify. What's that like behind the plate?
Yeah, I would say probably 5 to 7 years ago, it was a little bit more unique because there weren't that many guys throwing 98 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour, but it seems like each team has one or two guys that can get up to triple digits. The thing with Hicks is his ball has some movement. That's where it becomes pretty tricky. I had Zach Britton in Baltimore, and early on he could get it up there 96, 97 with movement, and it was his was a true sinker, right? Way different, but the fact that Hicks can get up to that 103, 105 range with even a little bit of movement, it does. It just makes you hard focus on more or less just hitting it in the pocket. And I've always found that if you catch the ball in the pocket against those high velocity guys, it will just frame itself. So when you really start to try and actually frame those type of guys is when it starts to get real stabby and jabby. When you just try and really focus on the pocket, have a nice, easy setup, and all you're trying to do is just tweeze that baseball, if that makes any sense. Take your middle finger and your thumb and just barely, like, squeeze the glove because they're providing all the power. It's going to stick in there as long as you just barely pocket it. Hit it in the pocket, and the ball ends up framing itself. So it's a little bit of both. You have to change your strategy just a little bit, but they have two very, very competent catchers back there that are pretty good at it. And after a bullpen session or two, they'll have them down, no problem.
When it comes to what you're calling back there, with a guy that has nasty stuff like this, the high velocity and the big sweeper that can generate swing and miss. Now, technically, he's got four pitches, the flat fastball, the sinker, the sweeper, and then a changeup he'll sprinkle into lefties. When you're back there, is like the better the stuff is, does it become more about reading the batter's swings and reactions versus maybe what the game plan was coming in?
Yeah, it's always, for me, Blake, to be honest with you, it's always about reading where that hitter is at and that pitcher is at any given day. And that's the job of the catcher. And that's what makes the position so fun for me is you go into a bullpen session and you feel like you have an idea of what they have. And then you're looking at what the tendencies are for both pitcher hitter. And then you're trying to figure out that guy standing next to you with a bat in his hand if he's got what he typically brings. And I can't tell you how many times on the fly you've got to adjust because you're not seeing what the reports are seeing. Maybe the guy had a long flight, couldn't sleep on the flight in. The hotel bed is not what he prefers, and he's got a little bit of a stiff back. You don't know that. And I'll give you a story. I remember years ago, it was one of the first times I was facing Miguel Cabrera, and this was years ago when he was a really, really good fastball hitter. And I think it was Gausman, maybe. I think it was Gausman throwing, and he was 95, 97, and Miguel just couldn't catch up to it. But the report was saying, sliders down and away, sliders down and away. And he was telling me that he wasn't catching up to the fastball, but I remember getting into a two-strike count, it probably called for a fastball, but I went with the report. It said slider. Before I knew it, he hit an opposite field two-run homer to kind of swing the game. And I'll never forget that moment that I had a catching coach, John Russell. He's now the AAA manager for the Tacoma Rainiers. He told me after that game, he said, trust your gut. Trust your gut. Your gut is right. Trust your gut. My gut was telling me to throw the fastball there because of what all of the external factors were telling me, taking into consideration that the scouting report said one thing as well. So, yeah, when it comes to Hicks, it's just going to be figuring him out as well, what his tendencies are. And you can have numbers, but he's going to have preferences that it's your job as a catcher to know. Like, he might throw, I'm just going to make a number up, 8% changeups to lefties, but I guarantee you it's coming in a very specific count against a very specific type of hitter. So knowing his preferences is massive too. And then you start to come up with a really nice game plan. And then you just read the situation, the scoreboard, all of that stuff. And when he's coming in, hopefully it's a tight game late, you know, where, well, not hopefully a tight game, but he's probably coming in a tight game late. But it's going to be a little bit pretty standard for him. But it's all these factors that you kind of round out.
So you mentioned that, you know, the catcher is going to have to pick up his tendencies, get to know him. What do you like to throw here and there? Certainly looking at, you know, some analytics and other information. You guys, as catchers, you're the busiest guy in the room the next week or so as the roster's in flux.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you a story that was so fun. Remember 2014, the Baltimore Orioles team I was playing on, we traded for Andrew Miller.
Oh, yeah.
And Andrew Miller at the time was the most dominant lefty out of the bullpen. And I remember facing him as a starter earlier on. I faced him when he was a reliever with Boston that year, and just filthy. I mean, just 95, 97, weird angle. He's massive, like 6'7". Big slider, and I remember us trading him over and thinking, man, this guy's so good. He hits the corners. He knows what he wants to do. He goes in there and gets in the clubhouse, and I'm walking up to him that day like, hey, like, you know, I'm Caleb Joseph, blah, 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 blah. The pleasantries out of the way, and I said, okay, so, like, what do you like to do? And he goes, oh, man, I'm really simple. And when you hear really simple, that's always usually a key indicator of I'm actually very, very complicated. I'm going, he's a bullpen guy. He's only got two pitches. He said, look, I don't really know exactly where it's going. Just set up down the middle. Sometimes it goes inside. Sometimes it goes outside. Just do your best to frame it. And I could not believe it. I was in total shock because when I was on the other side trying to hit him, it felt like he was painting corners left and right. He knew exactly what he was doing. But that's kind of the fun of getting new guys, is seeing them from your side now versus the opposition side. And some guys are really that easy, but some guys are difficult. So it is, it's kind of like getting a new toy at Christmas. Your really fun wish list comes true, and you get a new toy to kind of play with. And it's fun to kind of get to know them and know their tendencies. But there's a little bit of stress involved, especially early on, because you want them to succeed in their new home. So there's a lot of pressure on the catcher to quote, get it right. But at the end of the day, the guy that comes in holding the ball, he's going to make the final decision. So just do your best to present it as best as you can, and hopefully they get off to a good start.
Caleb, that 2014 team that you guys added Andrew Miller to, obviously that's one of the biggest acquisitions at the deadline that year. Then 2016 comes around, and of course that's the year that you guys end up meeting the Jays in the wild card. And the Orioles were more conservative that deadline. A couple additions in the post-waiver period when that existed, but nothing too major. And Kevin Gausman was talking to Shai Davidi last night about the Jordan Hicks acquisition, and he mentioned that he's been on teams before that didn't do much, and it was kind of like, why didn't we? We could have brought in this guy or that guy. So you having been on Orioles teams that were playoff bound and were aggressive, and then Orioles teams that were playoff bound that were a little less aggressive, what does that feel like in the room these next couple days? Is the Hicks addition and hey, whatever's next, is that going to give the room a shot in the arm? Are there rooms out there, maybe this year's Orioles team, that are looking around waiting for guys and being like, what the heck, we could make a run here? What is the vibe like on the player side these next couple days?
Oh, yeah, it's exciting. And I absolutely think that the Jordan Hicks addition is a total full vote of confidence in this team, that they know the management, the ownership, the fan base is 100% behind them. You said shot in the arm. That's the only phrase that I can think of in my head. It's just like one of the biggest pushes you can get. You know, imagine running a race, a massive marathon, and you're you're 75% of the way through. And just imagine somebody just picking you up and like carrying you for 10% of that race. It's what it feels like, because you're, you know, you're tired, you're exhausted, but then you get this acquisition and then it's like, yes, it's like this massive shot of energy into your body, knowing that, man, like we now have that kind of can't miss eighth inning guy that I think Kevin Barker is consistently talking about, that you guys are consistently talking about on the radio. And this is huge. This is big. And your windows in competitiveness are just way smaller than people realize. You know, to even look at the Orioles, like they have a ton of young players. They've got more even coming up. But I can't say how many times that just you get close to the finish line, you have to go for it. I'm one of those that believes that if you have a chance, you have to go for it, because you have what is right in front of you. And you can have all of the future planning as much as you want, but sometimes it just doesn't work out. And like you just alluded to, 2016, we were in a really good position. We added a couple people, but it wasn't really an over-the-top, like massive splash, like showstopper mic drop type of trade, and it couldn't push us over the edge. This trade for Jordan Hicks is a showstopper. It's a mic dropper. I think this was big. They went and got what arguably to me is probably the best right-handed reliever on the market. And just the name, just the miles per hour, it's an intimidating type of acquisition in terms of, you see that 105 on the other side, you don't want to face that. You know, I think read Matt Chapman saying that, man, I'm really glad I don't have to face that guy anymore, because that was a very uncomfortable AB. That's the kind of guy you want on your team when you're trying to make a push. I love it. I think it's great. I think the city should be absolutely pumped up, and I know the guys on the internal are absolutely pumped up as well.
Caleb, so you were never actually traded, but were there any instances where you thought maybe you'd be outbound? I'm trying to put myself in the position of, you know, a guy who could be going the other way in a deal or heading down to AAA or something like that. Was there a time at all you thought you might be out the door, or another catcher could be coming in or anything like that? What is that part of deadline week like?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, as the kind of the 24th, 25th, 26th, man on the team, it is a bit stressful, because you want to stay in the big leagues. The big leagues is such a unique, special place, and you kind of know that guys are trying to upgrade kind of the bottom portion of the roster. And yeah, it's stressful. I feared being traded in the offseason a couple times, but during the deadline, I was fortunate that, I mean, typically catchers aren't traded as much as the other type of positions, just because of what we talked about earlier with Jordan Hicks, trying to get them to know just one guy. If your team's really going for it, you're probably going to trade for like maybe a backup, maybe. But trying to go in and learn 12, 13, 14 new guys is really tough at this point in the season, and keep it flowing nicely. So I didn't have to worry about that. But I've had multiple players, multiple teammates that, once we made a trade, their spot was taken and they had to either be DFA released or sent down. And it's tough, because you feel like you've gotten there with those guys. You know, you feel like they've been a part of the success to get you to the position that you're at, and to just kind of say, see you later. It is tough. And these are humans involved, and they're friends, and you spend more time with them than you do your family during the season. And it's tough, but it's a reminder that it's a business, and the old line continues to ring true. If you don't like it, play better. So it is tough, but at the end of the day, the Toronto Blue Jays are trying to win a world championship, and the additions of Jordan Hicks and maybe another right-handed bat, maybe somebody else, that's what they're going to try and do. They're going to do it, and if it means a couple of guys have to lose their roster spot, it's just the nasty side of the business.
Last one for you, Caleb, before I let you go here. This is not trade deadline related, but curious as to your take. Friday, Apple TV Plus cameras pick up Matt Chapman with some choice words for John Schneider about the home run Kevin Gausman gave up to Shohei Ohtani. Now, obviously, Gausman wasn't trying to go middle and leave one there. The Jays played Ohtani pretty carefully the rest of the way, and Schneider joked about it a little bit after. But a player showing a bit of frustration like that in the dugout, is that kind of just par for the course, or would you have liked to see that handled a little differently?
Well, I love the intensity. I love the fact that he wants to win, and he doesn't want Ohtani to beat him. And I think everybody in that room shares that same sentiment. I can't say enough about the desire to win. I know it sounds crazy, but you would be shocked at how many guys on certain teams that I played with, they really didn't have that burning desire. It just kind of didn't really matter as much to them as it does some other people. I don't think that's the case one bit here in Toronto. That's a great sign. You just have to remember that when you are in uniform inside a building, there are cameras everywhere. And so you got to be really conscious of how you approach a certain situation. And I had a college coach one time tell me, it's never really what you say. It's always in your approach, whether it's publicly, whether it's with the tone, whether it's the choice of words. And I think that's totally spot on in this case. I think his intentions were good. His intentions were true. I think that everybody in that dugout clubhouse, they agree that they don't want Shohei Ohtani to beat him. But I think in the moment, I think he just got pretty jacked up. And we've all made mistakes. We've all said things in moments that we kind of wish we regret, even though we probably still believe in them. And so, yeah, I think it was a moment that I think Matty will kind of put back in the memory bank. But I love the intensity. I love the fact that he cares and his passion for winning a world championship for the Toronto Blue Jays. Just unfortunate that it was kind of caught on camera and that a couple people, you know, caught wind of it and kind of got put a little stir in the clubhouse a little bit, in that, you know, you can kind of ruffle some feathers. So there's a time and a place to kind of have conversations. And when you do it correctly, it usually brings a team together. You don't want any distractions pulling a team apart. But I don't think that's the case. I think John Schneider was able to really button that thing up really quick, and it's not a problem anymore.
Yeah, it seemed like they pushed past it pretty quickly. Caleb, you don't have to worry about what cameras catch this series. You're on radio. You're rejoining us in the radio dregs after a stretch of Blue Jays Centrals. Looking forward to you on the call with Ben Wagner for this Jays Orioles series that gets going tonight. Thanks for taking the time out this morning, man.
Yeah, you got it. It'll be a fun series. Hope the Jays really give us something to cheer about, because this is a big one. I mean, it's a big one. We'll see. It'd be fun.
It would be. It could be a huge one for AL East implications. The Blue Jays come into this series trailing Baltimore by 5.5. That was Caleb Joseph, analyst for Blue Jay Central, and on the call with Ben Wagner. Ben Wagner back for this series, so they'll have it for you on the Sportsnet radio network, which means it's a Joe Siddle Blue Jay Central series, I believe. All right. That is a big, big series. We will not tee it up a ton in the last segment here, because we've got Doug Fox coming on to talk about the prospects that Jay sent out, as well as big steps forward in the returns to play for Ricky Tiedemann and Brendan Barriera over the weekend. We're also going to talk to Ben Clemens of FanGraphs, who has a piece up on everything the Cardinals are doing here. He likes the Jordan Hicks fit with the Blue Jays. Spoiler for that one. But it is Chris Bassitt against Kyle Gibson tonight down at Rogers Center, 7 p.m. start. It'll be Hyunjin Ryu against Kyle Bradish tomorrow, Yusei Kikuchi against Grayson Rodriguez on Wednesday, and then a 3 p.m. start Thursday, we'll see Kevin Gausman against a big old TBD. If you're looking ahead, that would set the rotation up as Manoah Berríos Bassitt for three at the Red Sox this weekend. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Doug Fox for the prospect side of this Blue Jays trade and a look at what happened around the minors this weekend, and Ben Clemens of FanGraphs to take us through the national view of this Jays Cardinals deal. All that next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. So Jordan Hicks is in. Our next guest, probably his heart breaks a little bit anytime prospects are outbound. It's Doug Fox. He's at DM Fox 705 on Twitter. He's the writer of the Future Blue Jays newsletter, which you can check out on Substack at DM Fox. Doug, high level here. I know we all know that prospects aren't, we don't track them just because they're potential future major leaguers. They are also, unfortunately, we have to talk about these guys as trade chips and assets and things like that. I'd imagine in your position with the Future Blue Jays newsletter, it's got to be a little painful this time of year for you, right?
Absolutely. Blake, great show. Thanks for having me on. And you know, you start looking at things earlier in the season. You look at things like Rule 5 status for guys. Is that approaching? You look at a bunch of other things, and it's pretty obvious Semmerversa has been a target for quite some time with teams. And I guess with you always overpay at the trade deadline. That's no secret. But I think when Jordan Romano went on the injury list, I think dollar signs began dancing in John Mozeliak's head. And that's why all of a sudden now we've got Adam Klopfenstein included in the deal as well. And you hate to see them go, but you know this, you know what they say about prospects and parades. So I'm happy for both of those guys, having gotten to know both of them a little bit and gotten to know Robert's family. They're getting an opportunity with another organization. And as you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, they're in AAA now. So they're one step closer to the bigs. And while they're no longer in the Blue Jays organization, we'll still be keeping an eye on them.
Yeah, here's the thing is you don't want necessarily the prospects you trade out to be bad. You would like other teams to believe in your player development and think of your system as a strong one to pull from. I want to talk about Robertsa and Klopfenstein individually, but you mentioned something there, the proximity to the Rule 5 draft. So these are both players who come this winter, the Jays would have had to put on the 40-man or subject to the Rule 5 draft. Now, that is a down-the-line problem, to be sure, but in your history of covering prospects, how big a factor is that in, you know, if you're the Jays and your willingness to give something up? Obviously that means those guys are closer to helping the major league team, but from a flexibility standpoint, is that a key piece of this, do you think?
Well, what it says to me, and first of all, Klopfenstein was eligible last year,
right?
And wasn't selected. Don't know if that would be the case this year. What it says to me is they're not quite there. The organization maybe thinks they needed a little bit more time. And so this is how they can get some value back to those guys without potentially losing them in the Rule 5 draft, making the decision for them. I think that's what we're seeing in this kind of situation. And it's not every year do they have a 40-man crunch, but this particular year they have one at the moment, and they have one coming up in November once again. So hence the trade as well.
In terms of their proximity to the major leagues, what did you make of St. Louis's decision to immediately send both of those guys to AAA when they'd been pitching at AA for the Blue Jays?
Well, as we know, Klopfenstein was basically repeating AA, and Sem had spent almost a full calendar year at AA as well. So it's not surprising. It's a bit of an aggressive assignment for both of them. It possibly speaks to the Cardinals' pitching depth in the minor leagues or lack thereof, or maybe they're saying, you know what, these guys, we could lose them in the Rule 5 draft. Let's see what we've got against tougher competition. So interesting move, and not unheard of, but very interesting to see what happens.
Where were you at on both of these pitchers at this point? I know Robertsa, you know, Baseball America had bumped him up to number 7 in the system. Klopfenstein came in at 18. I know, we don't live and die by the rankings, but when you look at the Blue Jays system, how do you rank this asset cost or this asking price, given where you personally were on Robertsa and Klopfenstein?
Well, as Caleb said a couple of minutes ago when you had him on, you have to go for it. Mm-hmm. That's really what this trade is all about. And then you kind of throw valuations out the window a little bit to some extent. With Sem, I mean, such a great background. Learned to pitch by watching Pedro Martinez YouTube videos in Europe with a great find for the Blue Jays, a great scouting and development story. His secret is his four-pitch mix, his ability to command all of his pitches, his ability to sequence them very well, but the knock against him has been the velocity. And while it's gone up a little bit, he's still not one of those mid-90s guys. And the same could be true for Klopfenstein, who has turned his career around. This was a guy who was Northwest League Pitcher of the Year in 2019 and seemed to be on the fast track of the big leagues, and his career really got derailed. And last year, at Double A was quite a struggle for him, but he's learned to command the strike zone better, get away from the big innings, and he has added to be a little bit more as a chase pitch. So I think there are question marks that, once again, you know, the Blue Jays would be thinking about come Rule 5 time down the line, and so I think that's, yeah, there's certainly potential there, and especially with Roberto only being 21 and having still some room for projection, that's the risk you take, and that's the calculated risk that you have to take, and the Blue Jays obviously felt that that was the price they were going to have to pay.
Doug, you mentioned the Northwest League there. The trickle-down from this is almost surely going to be that very hot, very successful Vancouver Canadiens team and their fans are going to lose an arm or two here to the Double-A team. Do you have a guess on who that high-A pitcher we might see get the bump to take Robert or Clavinson's place might be?
Very interesting to see. I think you might see New Hampshire might take somebody like Luis Quiñones and turn him into an opener because he started in the past. So that might fill one of the gaps. As far as the other goes, you got to feel for the Vancouver fans. I mean, they're under no illusion that prospects, you know, what the price of having a prospect-laden team is that you'll lose players. Nick Frasso might have made the difference last year and might have brought a title to Vancouver, and that's a city whose hockey team isn't going to win anytime soon. So I can understand their desire. But if you were to look at potential candidates, Michael Dominguez was off to a bit of a slow start this year, but he's a guy in the off season. People I spoke to in the organization were very high on. You might see him move up. You might see a guy like Devereaux Harrison, who is still very new to starting, but was the Northwest League Pitcher of the Month for June, I believe. So one of those two, or maybe even a Rafael Sanchez. What does concern me is a couple of weeks ago, a guy I think would have been the obvious candidate was Diane Santos. Santos struggled a little bit, seemed a bit fatigued in a couple of his last starts, went on the IL on July 8th. And, you know, usually no news is good news, but not in the case of pitching prospects. And the Vancouver people apparently have not heard anything from the team. And that's very concerning. And that points to some more serious to issues. It also points to the up and down nature of pitching prospects and why you have to have a steady pipeline of them coming. But those are, I would say Dominguez might be the most likely candidate. He and Harrison would be one too.
Doug, I quickly, before we let you go here, one other name that could potentially restock that New Hampshire rotation is Ricky Tiedemann, who made a complex league start last weekend. He made a start at Dunedin this weekend. He threw three innings with just no hits allowed, one walk, six strikeouts. Is that a little too quick, or did you like enough of what you saw from Tiedemann in these? Well, I guess none of us saw the complex league start, but in that Double-A start to think, hey, or the Dunedin start rather, to think, hey, he could be back with Double-A before too long.
I did listen, and for people who like to follow the minor leagues, listen to Dunedin broadcaster, a gentleman by the name of Chris Valentine, if you can. He's awesome. He was very excited about Tiedemann's start. So I think there's obviously going to be a progression for Tiedemann, but he's definitely going to finish the year at one of the higher levels. What kind of pitch limit he's going to be on might be a different story. I don't think we should expect a whole lot from him this year. I think we're more gearing up towards 2024 for him.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Doug, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. I know you got a vacation ahead, but we'll talk to you in the later part of August.
Oh, looking forward to it, Blake. Thanks again for having me.
Doug Fox, author of the Future Blue Jays newsletter. You can check that out at DM Fox on Substack. You can check him out at DM Fox 705 on whatever we're calling Twitter. I can't bring myself to say to follow him on X or check him out on X or whatever. But a lot of good stuff there, Roberto and Clavinson. I mean, hey, Doug's been telling us since pretty early in this season that a lot of eyes, a lot of scouts have been at those Double-A games, keeping an eye on Roberto in particular. But if you've been listening to our chats with Doug, maybe you're not entirely surprised to hear that they're attractive trade chips and could help you get a Jordan Hicks. Ben Clemens of Fangraphs recently did, we had him on, we talked the big trade value, top 50. None of these names are top 50 trade value, but it's still been an interesting couple days for establishing the market here ahead of the deadline. The Cardinals, who have had a big hand in establishing that market on several fronts as one of the, we assume by the end, one of the more aggressive sellers. Ben Clemens of Fangraphs joins us now. Ben, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, man. So I know you wrote it up for Fangraphs last night. The Cardinals are having a fire sale. You kind of looked at both of those deals so far. Jordan Montgomery and Chris Stratton out to the Rangers in one. Jordan Hicks to the Toronto Blue Jays in another. And you were pretty positive about the Hicks to Toronto fit. What do you like about this addition for the Blue Jays?
Well, I think the tough spot that the Jays have been put in is that the Romano injury just came at such a terrible time where, look, they're not obviously in the playoffs. They're right on the fringes. And, like, their bullpen has a decent amount of depth, but it doesn't really have a lot of top end past Romano and, I guess, Tim Mesa. I mean, I like him, and he's been really good this year, but I kind of don't think it'll keep going. And Hicks happens to be – like pitching as well as he ever has right now. And I'm always of the belief that a reliever is about as good as his last, I don't know, five or six outings. Like, guys can just find it and then they're good until they lose it. And right now, Hicks is, he has it. Like, he's never struck out more batters. He's always going to walk a lot of guys. But, you know, if you're looking for a guy who's going to strike out a third of the batters he faces and the rest of them are probably going to be putting the ball on the ground, like, he's a really good fit. I don't think I'd feel worse with him at the top of my bullpen right now than with Romano. And that's a pretty nice kind of like do-over. It hurts really badly to lose your closer in a tight race. And hey, for the cost of two prospects, they get to undo that.
And then when Jordan Romano's back, you can mix and match a little bit. They're now the only bullpen in baseball with four guys with 30% whiff rates or higher. Swanson and Richards in that mix as well. When you look at the Blue Jays bullpen as a whole, and let's take the optimistic view of it and assume Jordan Romano's back and relatively decent at some point, do you think that this bullpen now has enough with the four kind of swing and miss righties, the Tim Mesa from the left side, the addition of Genesis Cabrera as well? Do you like where the Blue Jays bullpen's at right now?
I do. I think it's really tough to kind of predict bullpen, like how bullpen will do the rest of the year, because they just don't pitch enough. But if you made me go down all the contenders and say which bullpens I felt okay about and which ones I didn't, the Jays are squarely in the "yeah, I feel okay about this." And I don't think they really were when I was kind of totaling things up before then. And I mean, again, like, I'm going to say this a lot, but these are really small margins. The AL East is so hard this year, and the wild card race is essentially just like an AL East party with a little bit of AL West involvement, that, like, these games really matter. And yeah, I'm now much more confident in their bullpen than I was before today.
If we look at what else the Jays could do, because again, you're right, the margins here, and this is something we've talked about, that yeah, if you trade two starting pitching prospects for Jordan Hicks and he's a rental, you're going to lose probably the, hey, how much wins above replacement did each side get from that deal? But those are not created equal, and the marginal value of improving a Jordan Hicks spot right now is so large. Now, having said that, that works from here as well. You did not get your playoff odds to 100%. Is there an area you still look at this Blue Jays team and you know, here in Toronto, the focus has seemed to be on another right-handed bat, but do you see an area or a potential fit where you say, hey, the Jays could be a little more aggressive still, and this would make sense to me?
It's funny. This is the first time maybe in history that the Jays have been looking for a right-handed bat. Just been get left for as long as I can remember. I don't think they need a ton more. Like, I wouldn't mind seeing another reliever, except that who are they replacing? Like, the bullpen's pretty good at this point. I don't see what you're doing with an extra righty bat. I mean, I guess it lets you get Varsho out of the lineup against lefties, but he kind of is most of the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, him or Kiermaier or Belt, we just saw two lefties in a row, and they went eight righties in the lineup. I think the idea would kind of be, you know, that Espinal spot gets upgraded a little bit, so when you do that, you're a little bit more comfortable with it.
That makes sense. I mean, it was very fun when he was a power hitter for 2 months last year, but yeah, that's
he homered on like the weekend.
Yeah, there you go. I think that at this point, it's really chasing much smaller margins. If they do something, I'd expect it to be a really minor. Like, the Genesis Cabrera trade was the kind of thing that I could see them taking a shot on again. And those don't always work out. Look, acquiring the best Cardinals relievers kind of makes sense. Acquiring the guys they were DFAing when they're at 500, I don't know. That's less obvious to me, even though I like Cabrera and I like that move for the Jays, just as a kind of shot in the dark. I feel like this was the low-hanging fruit. Like, if you look at their roster and you look at how you're going to make upgrades, saying, oh, get a really nice top-end bullpen piece, preferably a rental so we're not shelling out too much. That was kind of like, you know, I don't know how many years in a row we said, let's get David Bednar at the deadline. This is just like the three-month version of that. I think it's a pretty smart move. I'd be shocked to see them do a lot more unless I'm totally misreading the situation. But I think their team sets up nicely, and the next improvement is going to be expensive, basically. Like, this one was pretty cheap. The next improvement is maybe to Kikuchi, but, like, Ryu's coming back. They don't really need more pitching depth, and it's going to be hard to get pitching top end because they have a pretty good top three. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think they're just maybe top two, and then, I don't know, take your pick of Bassett and see if Manoah has somehow rekindled things, see if Ryu has fixed himself. I just don't think the next upgrade is easy from here, and I thought this one was easy and obvious.
That makes sense. So let's look around the rest of that American League race, and you're right, it is pretty AL East heavy. Even the Yankees and Red Sox both coming in with about 28% chance to make the playoffs in the latest Fangraphs playoff odds. But it's been the AL West where things have been noisiest. The Angels making a couple of deals to try to make sure they make the playoffs at least once before Shohei Ohtani leaves. The Rangers being hyper aggressive. I know that you've mostly wrote about the NL deals over the weekend, but you did have something on Giolito and Reynaldo Lopez. The Rangers being incredibly aggressive right now. What do you make of the AL West, how that shapes up, and where any of those teams figure into, you know, I think the Astros are very clearly in the wild card spot, probably even jump the Rangers by the end. But when you look at, you know, a team like the Angels that's on the periphery, a team like the Mariners that we still don't really know what they're going to do, what do you make of the AL West here at part one of the deadline behind us?
Well, I think the Angels are done making upgrades. They just don't have anyone left to trade. Like, the pieces they have left to trade just aren't going to get them good enough major league pieces to matter. I like what they did a lot. If you know you have Shohei Ohtani only till the end of the year, like, you're going to be bad next year. You're going to be really bad next year. You'll probably be bad the year after that. They have a terrible farm system, and they're losing the best player in baseball, and they weren't good with him. So I like the idea of just kind of, you know, firing off all the fireworks you have remaining and make this the grand finale. I think that's very smart. I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. Like, I appreciate the move on their part, and I think it's smart. You got to play to your outs. But look, they're still long shots. That team's not that good, and there's a lot of teams to pass. On the other hand, the Rangers are kind of being smarter about the way that they're adding. Like, I think it was very smart of them to target specifically rentals with this deal, and to target Scherzer, who's like a short-term rental who's not going to blow up their payroll with the other. They're kind of like building their own Jacob deGrom to replace the one that got injured. And yeah, look, like, they had a pretty smart blueprint for the year. I think that they've been underrated as a front office and as just a team direction of saying, like, hey, we are close enough. We go out and sign some guys in free agency. This is going to work. Because, you know, teams do that all the time, and it doesn't quite come together, and they're still bad. And you're like, oh, why did they do that? I was wrong. Like, they did a really good job building this team around Semien and Seager. And I think it's very smart of them to supplement. Like, look, the guys that gave up, Luis Angel Acuna and Tekoa Roby mainly, but Sagasy, I can't pronounce that guy's name. So, but those three, they're not likely to have impacted the team in a huge way next year. And I don't think if you're the Rangers, you can be planning for 2025. Semien's in his 30s. Scherzer, if he still has it, he's not going to have it for much longer. You can never count on DeGrom staying healthy for that long. Same with Eovaldi. I think what they're doing is smart, which is kind of consolidating towards 23 and 24. Good moves kind of all around there. I think the Astros still have the edge, like you said, but my view, and obviously this is the percentage view, I'm not going out on a limb here, is that one of those teams will win the West. The other one will get probably the top wild card spot. It's just that they're both really good. And then two AL East teams will take the other two. Mm-hmm. And if you made me pick, I'd take the Jays and the Rays. But the Jays are in the most precarious spot, but I feel like the Rays have the most precarious trajectory, where we all I thought the Jays were better than the Rays coming into the year. I think pretty much everyone did. Like, they just looked better. And then I forgot that because they started off, the Rays started off so hot. And now that it's kind of close again, I'm like, wait a second. Like, looking down this Rays roster, it's not that good.
Yeah, and they got the they got the good news this weekend that Zach Eflin's not going to have to hit the IL. But we've also heard weird things that they're not looking where we maybe think they'd be looking. Ben, last one for you, but on the AL East here before I let you go, the Orioles remaining pretty quiet here. Of course, Shintaro Fujinami as an addition. They have been patience. But are they a team, like, are they close enough that you'd like to see them be a little more aggressive than we've heard maybe they're going to be?
Yes. I think that there's benefits to having a all the way tilted one way front office approach, which is what they have. They're just like patience all the time. And it pays off in the long run for them because they've been very smart about never trading for the present, always trading for the future. Look, that stacks up over time, but this is the time to go against that. Like, the top end of their farm system is so crowded with hitters. It just costs you a little less than it would cost a random team to trade a Colton Cowser or a Heston Kjerstad, because it's going to be hard to find those guys' spots. You know, it's like a upscale version of the problem that the Cardinals seem to have every year, where there's a lot of average hitters and not enough positions on the field for them. This is a good time to trade one of those guys and get some pitching. The one thing that is kind of awkward and that they've really shot themselves in the foot on is that the best pitchers have been moved. Like, I guess they could try to go get Justin Verlander. He has no trade clause. I don't know if he'd go to Baltimore. I don't even know if he's being traded. Regardless, they needed Jordan Montgomery. Like, that was a great fit for them. They needed Max Scherzer. That was a great fit for them. Their pitching staff is bad, and their hitters are great. And I think that they're making a mistake by not spending a little bit more prospect capital. They have so much. They're going to waste it. Like, this is a great time to be supplementing a good major league core. You don't know how many shots you're going to get to be in this position that they're in. I think it's kind of foolish, and it's penny wise, pound foolish to not be pressing a little bit here.
I think that makes sense. They just sent the guy who is ostensibly their number three starter all the way down to Double A to get right. They obviously have a need there. Maybe it's Jack Flaherty, and that's not as sexy as some of the other potential names. Marcus Stroman made sense to me until the Cubs went on a big run here and probably took themselves out of the seller's market. So I'm with you. Ben Clemens, thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy. Keep up all the great work at Fangraphs.
Thanks. Talk to you soon, Blake.
Ben Clemens of Fangraphs, one of my absolute favorite baseball analysts. He has some good stuff up. I mean, that trade value series is always worth going back at and looking at, but some stuff on the Giolito and Lopez acquisitions for the Angels, as well as if you are keeping an eye on the NL, he had a piece on the Dodgers grabbing Lance Lynn and Joe Kelly, and then again, a piece up last night on this Cardinals fire sale with a big chunk about Jordan Hicks landing with the Toronto Blue Jays. So lots of trade deadline stuff. Tomorrow, we're going to have extended hours on this show. We're going to go 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. That'll flow into a three-hour drive time with Ben Ennis from 1 to 4, and then a three-hour Blair and Barker 4 to 7. So we'll have basically wall-to-wall trade deadline coverage for you tomorrow, starting with Jays Talk Plus at 10 a.m. So there'll be a lot more of that to come. There's also a baseball series being played starting tonight down at Rogers Center, Jays and Orioles for 4. And this is about as big a series as it gets here in late July, early August, because the Jays are 5.5 back of the Orioles in the American League East. The Rays have come down to earth pretty dramatically. Whether you're taking a bite out of the Orioles to chase the division or to just solidify your standing in the wild card, there's a scenario where coming out of this series on Friday, the AL East is a very tight three-team race. There's also a scenario where coming out of this four-game series on Friday, the Jays are only focused on the wild card because they've lost enough ground to Baltimore. It's a pretty big swing series, as was the Angels series in terms of wild card positioning. So good to take 2 out of 3 there. It'll be Bassett against Gibson tonight, Ryu Bradish tomorrow, Kikuchi Rodriguez Wednesday, and then Gausman versus TBD on Thursday. We will, of course, be talking about tonight's game tomorrow on the show, even though it will be more heavily deadline focused. Now, if you need more Jays stuff, which of course you do because it's deadline week, Marchese and McKee are coming up next. Blair and Barker are in the 5 to 7 slot. Blair and Barker also have you for Jays Talk post game after the game tonight. Will we get more transactions tonight or will they wait for tomorrow? Selfishly, I hope they wait for like 10:04 tomorrow morning, and then they keep flowing until 1 p.m. That would make for the most fun show. Today's show was a fun one. Thanks to Ben Clemens. Thanks to Doug Fox, Caleb Joseph, Katie Wu, Shai Davidi for all coming on. Thanks to Jeff, Luke, and Jennifer behind the glass. Again, we're 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. tomorrow. Extended hours for the trade deadline. Marchese McKee next, Blair and Barker 5 to 7, and Bassett against Gibson tonight. It's going to be a really fun couple of days here. Hope you guys enjoyed today's show, and we'll talk to you for 3 hours tomorrow. Jordan Hicks is in, Sam Roberta, Adam Kloffenstein out. We'll see what else unfolds. JStock Plus back tomorrow at 10 a.m. on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.